This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
This is the Dying to Tell podcast series.
On this podcast, you'll hear Jesse Williams, the Executive Director of the Groundswell Project, and Helen Callanan, a doula and founder of Preparing the Way.
If you're dying to know, we're dying to tell.
On the 8th of August, the 5th Dying to Know Day, a national annual day of action dedicated to bringing to life conversations and community action around death and dying, will be recognised here in Melbourne and across Australia with a series of events. Here to talk with us about Dying to Know Day and some of these events, I have on the line Jesse Williams, the Executive Director of the Groundswell Project, and here in the studio, Helen Callanan, a doula and founder of Preparing the Way. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jesse and Helen, you have partnered to put together an event for Dying to Know Day. But firstly, let's talk a little bit about your different roles and organisations and how Dying to Know Day came about. So let's begin with you, Jesse, as you're in Sydney. Can you explain the aims of the Groundswell Project and how and why you became involved?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you for having us, Stephanie. Look, the Groundswell Project was formed by two extraordinary women 7 years ago. So I wonder if I could tell the genesis story and then perhaps the context of why we exist.
Yes.
So we were founded by Peter Murray, who's a celebrated Australian playwright based in Melbourne, and Kerry Noonan, who's a clinical psychologist who works in palliative care in Sydney. And they were both at a health conference, and the usual conversation was going on about why Australians, you know, aren't planning for end of life, aren't sharing their wishes with their loved ones. But there was a sense that there was this othering going on, that it was sort of it was other people's problem that they weren't doing that. There was not an inquiry around why are we so poorly equipped at talking about death and talking about our end of life plans. So Peter and Kerry said, well, we've got to do this differently. We've got to do death differently in the West. So the Groundswell Project was born, and we were really founded with this idea that we really want to develop creative and profound ways of engaging with death as an everyday part of life, because indeed it has always been a part of life. It's always been a part of the human experience. For 200,000 years we have died in our communities and in our homes, but something changed, and something changed around the turn of the century. When your grandmother's grandmother was alive, we of course developed some incredible medical advancements that meant that we were living better and longer. We were managing chronic disease, we were managing infection. But as a result of that, the good stuff that came out of that meant that we actually started to outsource our death and dying. We outsourced it to the aged care industry, we outsourced it to hospitals, and we outsourced it to the funeral industry. And so the impact of that for us now as a society is that we've really had two or three generations of people where we have not grown up seeing, sensing, smelling, touching death. So it's really quite a surprise when it happens. And that's the context that we exist in. That's why Groundswell was born. We are an arts health organization. We're national. And we're really here to amplify what we see as a social movement to bring death and dying back into our communities, and indeed demedicalize the dying experience to the extent that people want it to be demedicalized.
And I guess destigmatize it too.
Absolutely. So we love to do social polls, and we asked on Facebook last year, is referring to the topic of death as taboo helpful? And actually the insight that came to us in the conversations in community was that if you can say something's taboo, it's actually not taboo, right? Something that's really taboo will not even get discussed on Facebook. So We don't think it's taboo. We do understand that it's a bit weird, and we do understand that it can be a bit nerve-wracking, but we find the minute someone cracks open that nut, everyone wants to talk and you can't shut them up.
Jesse, you mentioned in your opening words here in the West. Do you find inspiration from other cultures around the way that they talk and deal with end-of-life care and death care?
Yeah, look, of course. I think that's very natural, isn't it? We tend to not see our own culture. We see others. So we get inspiration from, you know, the Day of the Dead. I hasten to say it in Mexican. I probably haven't got the right language around that. But, you know, a national day in other cultures where there's a celebration of mortality is very inspiring to us, because indeed death is all around us, but we don't celebrate it and we don't see it for what it is. We do have a lot of cross-cultural conversations in Dying to Know Day, where different cultures can bring forth their objects, their language, their ritual around death and dying. And I think there's an envy for those of us who are Westerners. I think there's an envy that's there of a loss of ritual or a lack of ritual that we have. I know, you know, whenever I ran a workshop recently where we had a Greek lady there, and she said, oh, we Greeks, we do it really well. We have 40 days of caring in the lead up to the death, and then 40 days of caring in the grief. We don't ask people, how can I help? We just show up and we do it. And I remember sitting there going, God, I wish I had that. I wish I was Greek.
So, Jesse, perhaps that gives me the perfect segue to introduce Helen Callanan. Helen, you are a doula. Tell us, who is a doula and what do they do?
It was originally from the Greek, as you say, and I think originally was pronounced thule. Originally was translated as slave. However, we've come to use it now as like a person of service.
A doula. Okay.
A doula, yeah.
So tell us, who is a doula and what do they do?
So a doula is a non-medical role, and they provide support, options, resources to someone, and traditionally they're around birth, but of course it's majorly in the end-of-life world now as well. In the UK, US and Canada, end-of-life doulas are really quite prevalent, and it's an emerging industry here in Australia. And really it's about, to me, having a doula is having someone walk alongside you on your journey, whatever that is for you, in your culture, in your tradition, and supporting you by letting you know what choices there are, what options there are, and then supporting you fulfilling those. It's not about a doula rowing their own boat, right? They're here to have your back and support you, doing what it is in your family and your needs and helping meet those.
Okay. So perhaps you can give us some specifics around that, mm-hmm. Helen. Is it more of an administrative sort of mm-hmm. role, or is it more of a spiritual and mm-hmm. emotional supportive role?
Yeah. Each and every case, I've been a doula for a little over 30 years, and each and every situation is different. There are times that I go in and I'm a bit like an event planner, you know. You think about it, we plan our weddings, we plan our vacations, we plan our retirement, we plan our births, but we don't plan our end of life. And there's a lot to plan, right? So sometimes I'm a bit like an event planner. Sometimes I'm there as an emotional support, you know, spiritual support. Sometimes I'm helping someone go to appointments and navigate the whole medical world and understand that language and ask the hard questions. Sometimes I'm actually helping people explore, you know, what options there are for care at home and support for the family. Sometimes I'm acting like a network bringer-togetherer, you know, because there's some research being done, which I'm sure Jesse might mention more about, through the Sydney Western University about end of life. They did a lot of research on people actually at end of life. And what they found was that for a person to die, you know, effectively at home, that there's a network needed, that there's a, you know, about 16 people is what they averaged and found that is needed to support people to die effectively at home. And people want to die at home. You know, the stats that have come out of Groundswell are that between 70 and 80% of people want to die at home, 14% do. Do you know why? Why is that, right? And part of it, not all of it, but part of it is that there's not enough support for the families, for the carers, et cetera, at home. And that's where a doula can come in helping bring that team together, helping provide, where are the gaps, helping fill those gaps so that this can happen, you know, in a supportive and easy transition.
Okay, so as the founder of Preparing the Way, mm-hmm. how did that organisation come about?
Yeah, well, that's incredible because, as I said, I have been a doula for a long time. I didn't even know the word doula existed. I was just doing my thing, right, which is working with families and at end of life and providing support. And I actually have been a Reiki practitioner and teacher for 30-something years. And so I've just worked a lot with people in hospitals, hospices, palliative care, in their homes, that are dying and at end of life. And so I got known for doing my thing. And then I met up with Renee Adair, who is the founder and director of the Australian Doula College for Birth. And she's and they have a cert for in birth doula services. And she's like, Helen, I really need you. You've got all of this skill and background. I really need you to put together you know, something, because I'm getting people ringing up because they have an agency where you can ring up and say, hi, I'm pregnant, I need a doula. She said, I'm getting people ringing up going, hi, I've got someone in my family dying. Do you have a doula? Because it's starting to get known now, right? And she said, and I have doulas and other people asking, do you train end-of-life doulas? So put together a program for a basic sort of foundation level of death and dying and end-of-life education, and then put together an intense three-day program. And so Preparing the Way now both trains doulas, and I am actively a doula as well.
It sounds like something that we should all be doing, and not just, you know, if you do want to go into that kind of work, but just as a life skill.
You know what? I really agree in the point that Jessie made is so spot on, that we've forgotten how this was done in everyone's home only a few hundred years ago. We took care of our dying. We laid our people out in the front room. The men built the coffins. We did this at home. It was organic, natural. Now, because it got institutionalized, we've forgotten. And so really, to me, it's about what I feel like, you know, Preparing the Way's mission is, first of all people know their options and know the choices that are there, but also can reclaim that, I think, part of our ancestral, you know, capacity, which is to take care of our elderly, take care of our dying. And, you know, and we've got a lot more death now that's happening, not only the elderly, but we've also got a lot of other more complicated in youth and other diseases and things that are happening now. And, you know, you may have heard the term that it's not particularly attractive, but it's descriptive, which is that there's a silver tsunami coming. And this is about the baby boomers, the sheer volume, the demographic of the, and I'm one of them, you know, where we're aging and we're going to be dying. And there will never be enough room in any institutions to handle the volume that's coming. We have to reskill. And you're right, I think it is something that for everyone to learn. And you know what I find, and it's what Jessie was also saying, people come to the workshops and they're a bit like, oh, sort of, you know, we're talking about death for the whole day, you know, oh, my God. You know what? They leave excited because it's, you know what it is? It's that knowledge gives power. Exactly. And it's the lack of fear. Fear is dealt with because they have more capacity and knowledge.
So why are we so afraid of talking about death? And I know Jessie touched on medicalization, mm-hmm. and you know, sort of the over-sterilization of the whole funeral and death care process. Mm. What do you think why we are so afraid of talking about death?
Well, I think for me what I see is that people have, and if you like, here in Australia in particular, I'll speak about that, is that, you know, we have a she'll be right mate. You know, we don't want to be a burden. We have all of these attitudes, and it's like, if I don't talk about it, it won't happen. You know, it's almost like a superstitious thing, rather than people getting real and going, you know what, I don't know anyone who's got out of here without dying. You know, it's coming our way for every single one of us. So I think it's a lot of internal questions. And I'm sure Jessie, I'd love to hear what Jessie's, you know, got to say about that too. But I see a lot of it as being personal fear that has become cultural and it's become a habit.
Jessie, would you like to add to that, those sentiments?
Oh, yeah, echoing everything Helen has said. I also think the paradox is that there's a belief that we notice in our workshops that comes through, which is, if I talk about it, it will happen. So there's an opposite superstition. And And look, you know, honestly, I think the only thing I would have to add there is this, you know, loss and grief and sadness are uncomfortable emotions. And we all know what our daily lives are like in this world right now. And it's this, they're stuffed full of ideas and thoughts and things, usually sort of past focused or future focused, but not necessarily present focused. And to be in the present means to feel feelings, and to feel feelings means to feel loss, and to feel loss is uncomfortable. So I think that is how I would sort of unpack some of those reservations that we have. But as Helen said, when we invite people to talk about death, we're actually inviting people to talk about their mortality. And when we invite people to talk about their mortality, what comes to life is the richness of our relationships, the depth of our love, the appreciation we have for being alive. And that is the juicy bit. That's kind of almost feels like a secret, that what we call the deathies, the people who, you know, really lean into this conversation, need to share more, that it's actually a very delicious conversation, and it brings into light just how you are living your life, and then you make the most of it, right? You enhance it.
So, Jesse, how do you start this conversation?
You just do it, huh? You know, we get asked at Groundswell a lot from bureaucrats in health, how do we get people to talk? And our answer is always the same, just do it. You got to have the ovaries big enough sometimes just to do it, but just do it. And so we model this. So, for example, I talk about death in a corporate environment. We run this program called The Compassionate Workplace. I run workshops at 7:30 in the morning for, you know, sometimes it's a room of bankers talking about death and dying over coffee and croissants in a high-towered building before they start their day. And at 7:30 in the morning, I welcome them and I say, we're going to talk about death. Crack, done, let's do it. And everybody starts talking. Yeah.
In case you have just joined us, I have in the studio with me Helen Callanan and on the line, Jesse Williams. And we are talking about Dying to Know Day. So how did Dying to Know Day come about, Jesse, and why August?
Oh, well, look, we scanned the world for all those days, the white ribbon days and the pink ribbon days, and we found that August was a light month, so that's why we chose August. Nothing more
practical.
Yeah, very practical. And it's within a few weeks of Palliative Care Week too nationally, so that's a nice thing, because obviously palliative care is the service that provides support for end of life from the health system. So we work in partnership with palliative care wherever possible. Look, we're in our fifth year now. It came about because, as Helen was saying, Helen got approached to do training for doulas. We were approached to hold more events and more opportunities for people to talk about end of life. We were compelled to, and we had to. We founded it, we launched it at FBI Radio, actually in Sydney, and it was really on the back of the inspiration of a book called Dying to Know, it was an alternative approach to health promotion, where we weren't giving people brochures. We were focusing a national campaign around a beautiful book that has beautiful photographs and sage words that bring to life conversations and social actions around death, dying and grief. So the arts practice shines through this campaign in a very big way.
So in 2016 on Dying to Know Day, there were events that involved dinners and storytelling, webinars, afternoon teas. What's planned for this year? And specifically, what have you planned together at Federation Square here in Melbourne?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll say a little bit about nationally, and then perhaps Helen can talk about the event. So, you know, we never know what's going to happen for Dying to Know Day. We never know what the community is going to come up with. So what Groundswell's purpose is we launch the day on social media. We develop some communication tools, so some posters, some memes, some words to really kind of, you know, I suppose disrupt a fairly ageist view of death and dying. So we call it the wrinkly hands approach, you know, not that there's anything wrong with wrinkly hands, but we want to bring quirk into it. We want to bring fun into it. So the strap line for this year is, what if talking about death didn't even raise an eyebrow? So we then give all of those tools to the community, and the community come up with the ideas for the events. At the moment, they're being, you know, registering. We see the ticker going up each day. More and more events are coming online, and we're always dying to see what ideas are coming forth. But perhaps, Helen, you can talk about the Fed Square event a little bit more.
Oh, with much pleasure. I'm so excited about it. As I said earlier, preparing the way, our biggest commitment is around all people, and that's a capital A, capital L, capital L, all people.
We love that here at Joy.
Exactly. having choice and options and empowered around end of life and everything that entails. And so, of course, meeting up with Jesse and Kerry and the Groundswell crew and knowing what they did and being involved in that, I've always been so impressed with their work and that they are, you know, fierce and tireless in their approach. So I approached them about, like, let's do something. Let's create something big in Melbourne, right? And so Fed Square, to me, it's so iconic. It's in the centre of Melbourne and apparently is the site of a Aboriginal meeting place originally. And I think it was also the home of the first city morgue, you know, so it's literally like got some history there. And so what we've created is the biggest ever Dying to Know Day event. And so it's on August the 8th. That Fed Square goes from 10 a.m. until 6:30 p.m. We're going to have like up to 30 people exhibiting. So things around educational things, you know, we might have some beautiful wicker caskets there, like things for people to go, wow, did you even know this exists, you know? Mm-hmm. Sustainability and environmentally friendly stuff is important to people now. What options are out there? So really a day of education. We're going to have the, looks like we're having the Threshold Choir. They're going to come because they actually go into hospitals and things and sing for people who are close at end of life. And they're going to use that as a we're going to have demonstrations of that. We're going to have Sue Peters-Hawk is coming to speak with people. We're going to have other celebrities talking. We're going to have a stage set up with, you know, a screen above it. And we're just going to have a massive day of conversation. But you know what? What both I'm really big about that, you know, I'm really over the Grim Reaper stuff and all of that dark and scary stuff. Because to me, death's not that. I've been around it way too much. Death is actually a beautiful time of privilege and of rare, precious time, you know. And so, and it's about life. You know, death to me is a part of life. It's not some singular event. And we want to celebrate life at Dying to Know Day and having people have options and know everything so that they can live as they choose right up until that last breath, you know.
So just, you know, thinking about some of the events that you have got planned for that day. Jesse, in your mission statement, you mention innovative arts and health programs. What have you found to be the most effective forum for change?
Oh, great question. Gosh, you put me on the spot there. It's good. Look, to us, the most effective form of change is when people take action. So, you know, we can philosophize around death and it's kind of fun to do that. Death is the absence of consciousness. And when you think of it in that way, you're like, wow, I could wax lyrical. But actually, am I going to tell my lover, my partner, my best friend or my best mate how I want to have that last day? Because chances are I will have a conscious experience of knowing that I'm dying. So I will have the chance to know that I'm dying and to choose where I'm going to be and what's going to happen. Have I told the person most dear to me what I want that to be like? The dog on my bed, for me, it's Talking Heads. You know, I've got to have Talking Heads playing, my favorite band. Have I told somebody that? So in our workshops, we run a workshop called 10 Things to Know Before You Go. It's not a travel workshop, although in some ways I suppose it is. But
it is. It's that final journey. I often use that analogy, yeah.
80% of people who come to that workshop take action, and we're very proud of that impact. When we look at the ingredients as to why they take action, the ingredients are they're in a group of people who are all on the same page. They're all willing to go there and they're willing to talk about it and they're willing to be frank. They are, as Helen said, armed with knowledge. So when we talk about the 10 things, for example, doctors die differently. Why is that? Well, because they can navigate the health system and they can make choices. What does that mean for us who have perhaps a low level of death literacy when we're suddenly thrust into a hospital system and we don't understand it. So having those kind of edgy conversations build this massive motivation. And then knowing your options. Yeah, burial and cremation, that's two ways. There's probably about seven currently in Australia ways to dispose of a body. It's kind of exciting to learn that stuff. So, yeah, I hope that answers the question. But
yeah, and I mean, how do we improve death literacy?
Well, so death literacy was a research term that was coined by Groundswell and the Bringing Our Dying Home, a research group that Helen mentioned at Western Sydney University. It came out of a multi-year research study that we did where we worked with communities to do qualitative studies around watching people care for people dying at home and their grief and their journeys. Death literacy is the practical know-how to plan for and respond to end of life and death. And the most important ingredient in death literacy is actually the learned experience or the lived experience. So we develop our death literacy by the act of caring. So we develop it by getting stuck in there and visiting our friend who's dying of cancer with the lasagna or with the dog lead and just showing up and saying, I'm here. Not tell me if you need me or call me when you know what you need, but I'm here and I want to get stuck in with you. You develop a confidence that comes from that, and then you want to pay it forward. And this is where I think the social movement's growing so quickly, because so I have a personal experience around this. My first baby died 15 years ago. We took his body home from the hospital. We had 3 days with him at home. My whole family met him. My whole community met him. And people still to this day talk about that experience, and they developed a confidence from that experience that they can now help other people who are grieving. They're more likely to get stuck into the role of carer because of that formative experience. So for us, that's really what death literacy is.
Okay. And Jesse, just staying with you for a moment before we go back to Helen, what for you have been some of the greatest successes of Groundswell during your few years with the organisation?
I would think, firstly, we're very proud of having an artist in residence in a palliative care ward in a 20-bed ward hospital. 20-bed palliative care ward in a very large hospital. Hospitals are generally quite risk-averse systems, and to have a beautiful artist working in that system with people in their dying days is quite extraordinary. I think, too, we're very excited about a new project that we've got going with Southern Cross Care. So it's the first aged care provider that has really kind of come to us, and we've come to them and we've said, how could residential aged care be different? We're going to put a community development worker, an arts worker, to work with a residential care facility over 3 years to engage the community in a 10-kilometre radius around that residential care facility. And we think it's going to transform that residential care facility from a place of, I don't want to go there when I'm old, to I can't wait to go there because there are young people there doing arts programs, and that's a place of life that I want to be in. So I think that is the future that we're leaning into. We're very excited about that.
And that's really interesting, because just coming back to your mission statement where you do mention innovative arts and health programs, you seem to have combined the two. You know, it's not one or the other. It's you know, arts within a health environment. It's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for articulating that. Yeah, I think you're right. Arts is something that illuminates, doesn't it? So,
and coming back to you, Helen, how involved have you been in Dying to Know Day in the past?
In the past, last year, I actually went to an event, and it was actually put on by the Natural Death Advocacy Network here in Melbourne, and it was all about conversations, and we had some hypotheticals like, okay, there's this person and they're this age and this is the family and, you know, there's this situation going on and they're at end of life. And we sat around as a group and discussed these different scenarios and looking at what could I bring to that. And I think the thing for me is, you know, one of the things I got at that event, and then also I've seen in my work as a doula, and also that I think is also what's emerging, what Jesse was referring to there about the community, that, you know, we really can't afford to, and I think one of the things that makes death so scary for people is that often we isolate ourselves You know, we go, people reach out, you know, we'll say, oh, I'd love to do something to help. And we go, no, thanks. You know, we need to be going, yes, yes, yes. And there's evidence coming out of the UK of studies that have been done there. And a new term that is getting talked about a lot now here in Australia is compassionate communities. So starting to really develop the networks around people and having people, if you like, not live in isolation, because that's where fear lives, do you know? And
yeah, here at Joy, you know, we're really proud to provide a platform to the LGBTI community to provide their, you know, as a place to provide their stories.
Yes.
How important to you are the stories around what you're doing and the shared experiences?
When I teach, I teach all through stories, you know, and because that's where the rubber hits the road. And when I'm sharing a story that's from my direct personal experience, with someone, people are able to reach it. You know, people can see it. They can put themselves in it. If when you're creating a narrative like that, like a story, people can live inside that and see it applying to them. And I use story all the time, and I think it's a crucial part of our way of sharing information with people. It's not about throwing a heap of data at people and all of that. It's like sharing a story where people can find their way inside that, you know, and it gives them a living example. And, you know, to me, inside, you know, I remember asking, someone asked me a question, so what can we offer the LGBTI community? I'm like, you know what? They're part of our community, you know. It's not about that they're separate here. All people, whatever of anything, deserve this information, deserve this freedom, deserve to have this access to power in their lives at one of the important events that comes to every one of us, you know.
It's interesting you mentioning, you know, death obviously doesn't discriminate. Jesse, are there any events that you know nationally or from the past that have included specifically LGBTI folk?
Yes, look, I do have a whisper of a memory where there was a LGBTI film screening and celebration for one event. I can't remember where it was, but yes. So we do see them slowly filtering through. I think showing film is a very powerful medium, isn't it? To collectively watch a film and then digest it together as a group afterwards. And look, there may be some. So Death Cafe is it's a very simple idea. Almost, if you want to kind of put your toes in the water, sometimes a Death Cafe can be a good thing. And there are death cafes. I know there was one. So a death cafe is where you come together with no set agenda and you talk about death with, you know, cake and a cup of tea or a glass of champagne. And I know there was one LGBTI death cafe specifically in the Blue Mountains last year. So anyone can host this in their community with their peer network, with their friends and family.
And is Death Cafe something? I know that, you know, the first Death Cafe I attended was in the inaugural Dying to Know Day here in Australia. Is that something that you encourage on the 8th of August, or is it something that you encourage at any time?
At any time.
Oh, yeah, great.
Anytime. But also, you know, I mean, the 8th of August, like many days of action, is just something that we can almost just used to legitimize what we really want to do all the time, you know. So hang your hat on it. And so, you know, people are running events in the week leading up and the week post, and actually the whole month of August turns into a bit of a death fest, to be honest.
So, Jesse, just in winding up, perhaps you can tell me about how the event has grown since it's in inaugural year.
Yeah, look, I'm terrible with numbers, so I can't give you those exact ones. But I know that in the first year we did have about 40 events, and we were bowled over. We were so excited, Kerry, Peter, and I. We were just thrilled, and we always, you know, we get a bit nervous in the 3 weeks in the lead up when we watch the ticker go. We go, God, are we going to get many more? And then suddenly there's this rush of registration, because people have been imagining them for a long time and finally getting around to it. So it's organically grown each year, you know, starting with 50 now to, I think it was 261 from last year. It's not health funded, you know, we're not health funded in any way. So this is a campaign that is driven by the community with no sponsors, no funding. It's just something that's very organic. So I think that's an extraordinary thing. And we've gone international. We have an American counterpart. They're called Bevival. They combined being with revival, Bevival. They had their first Dying to Know Day last year with, I believe, 20 to 30 events. They're relaunching a new website this year, and they're bigger and better, and they're on the East and West Coast. We also get three or four events from Brazil, actually. Mm. So we're heading over to Canada in September to speak at a conference there, and we'll be popping into New York. So I think we'll be looking at a more international scope next year.
So, Jessie, if people do want more information on Dying to Know Day, where do they find out about it?
www.dyingtoknowday.com, I believe. If you just put Dying to Know Day, it'll come up. Please just go to look at the events that are registered. You can go by state, by location. If there's nothing there that you want to attend, or that's nothing there in your region, reach out to us, because we have a lot of contact with people on the ground, and it might be that an event just has not been registered yet. And perhaps we can even talk to you about what ideas you have. A Dying to Know Day event can be as simple as four friends over with a bottle of wine. So don't ever forget the simplicity of holding these conversations.
And Helen, if people want to contact you, how do they contact you?
Through inquiries at preparingtheway.com.au, and the website is www.preparingtheway.com.au.
You have been listening to Helen Callanan, doula, and Jessie Williams, who is the executive director of the Groundswell Project on Joy 94.9.
You've been listening to Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families. Sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.